Welcome to the Dermatology Interest Group Association podcast, or DIGA podcast, where we talk about everything from how to become a stellar dermatology applicant to interesting topics in dermatology.
From research advice to interviewing tips, you will be prepared to follow the path to become a world-class dermatologist.
Hello again, everyone. My name is Grace Hobine, and I'm your host on this episode of the DIGA podcast. I talk with Dr. Mary Margaret Crinn, the chair of the Department of Dermatology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. We have an amazing discussion on her research on the quality of life of dermatology patients, as well as her development of the Skindex tool for measuring quality of life. So without further ado, see you on the skin side. Welcome, Dr. Mary Margaret Crinn, to the DIGA podcast.
Happy to be here, Grace, and great talking with you. I am a professor and chair of the Department of Dermatology at Vanderbilt, and I'm a health services researcher when I wear my research hat, but my clinical hat is a dermatologist, a general dermatologist.
How did you know that a career in dermatology was right for you?
So I trained first in internal medicine, and I have to say in medical school, I never even took a derm elective. I don't know why, it's just I always wanted to go into internal medicine. And I trained in medicine and then practiced internal medicine in a small community practice outside of Boston for some years. And during that time, I'm certain that I sent scores, if not hundreds, of patients to the local dermatologist because I didn't really know how to begin to think about how one might treat skin problems in the general internal medicine practice that I was in. But then, like a lot of people, I had a few pivotal patients who made me think about whether I might want to specialize in dermatology, including a patient who was NED from his testicular cancer and was just getting consolidation chemotherapy and developed TEN from one of the drugs that he was given. And I remembered watching the dermatologists come around and round, and it was very interesting how they approached the patient and matched my interests as well in thinking more specifically about the pathophysiology of one disease rather than trying to be an expert at a lot. So I had the mind of a specialist. So then I trained in dermatology at University Hospitals in Cleveland. And while I was there as a dermatologist, I had the experience of doing an elective that was a research elective. It actually happened to be an ethical issue, but it made me realize that I really liked thinking about a problem. I was very curious about research questions, certain research questions, and wanted to study more how to be an independent investigator. So after residency, I did a two-year research fellowship in clinical epidemiology at University Hospitals in Cleveland, and then started my research career at that time. About 5 years in, I moved to UCSF. And was an independent investigator there, which, you know, we can talk about what that means. But after doing that for a decade or so, I started to think about leadership roles in dermatology and had the opportunity to come and be chair at Vanderbilt.
So what does it mean to be an independent investigator?
A researcher, this is a simplistic model, and there are definitely different ways to combine research and education and clinical care in your academic life. But for many investigators, they spend the majority of their time, even if they're clinicians like I was, they spend the majority of their time doing research. So what does that mean? That means asking questions, thinking up hypotheses to explain interesting observations in the clinic, and then testing those hypotheses either in the lab or in patients or in using data sets. So independent investigator often is also trying to seek out ways to pay for the studies. And so he or she is always thinking about how can I get funding. The major funders in the United States are the NIH and the VA. Then also thinking about how to disseminate results from his or her work. And so the researcher spends a fair amount of time preparing manuscripts of results and publishing those.
It sounds like you had cultivated your interest in research quite early in your journey to dermatology. What other factors contributed to your ultimate desire to pursue leadership positions in academic dermatology?
Yeah, so I always tell our residents here at Vanderbilt that, you know, we're always, everybody we train in the residency, we want to train a leader. So remember, a leader can be the best doctor in the community. And by best, I mean the person who's trying to give each patient the best care for him or her. A clinical dermatologist can be a leader in organized dermatology. So there are many ways to be a leader. Certainly in an academic setting, one can be a leader in the education realm. And clinician educators are the centerpiece of many departments of dermatology. In research, one can be a leader by asking important questions and then performing really rigorous studies to answer those questions. In my own experience, I did clinical epidemiology, a research fellowship in that, and that really is the branch of science that focuses on the clinical encounter. So the idea is that the quality of medical care can be improved by meticulously measuring aspects of the clinical encounter and then performing studies to examine interventions that will improve that encounter. So I was sitting as a research fellow learning a lot about measurement, and I went to a research meeting, and it happened to be a presentation by a rheumatologist. And the rheumatologists have a lot of similarity with the dermatologists. And think about it, they care for patients with chronic diseases, by and large, that do not affect survival. A lot of patients with rheumatologic disease live with their diseases, don't die from them. And the rheumatologists faced a problem about how to measure the course of disease over time. How do you find out if the patient is better because you've taken care of them? For many rheumatologic diseases, let's just take one for instance, probably the most common, osteoarthritis. There are no laboratory studies to see if you made the patient better. You could examine the osteoarthritic joint, but it often doesn't have an effusion or warmth or any kind of physical signs. But really what you want to know is the patient feel better because you took care of them, because your therapy worked. So this very compelling rheumatologist was describing this and how the specialty of rheumatology had come up with rigorously developed measures of how the patient is doing. And I got a little light bulb in my head and I said, wow, that's just like us in dermatology. We need a measure of how our skin patients are doing, those who have chronic skin diseases, which is the vast majority of patients that we see. So I started thinking about how could I develop such an outcomes measure? And a major outcome for skin disease is how the patient's doing, their quality of life. And so I worked with social scientists to figure out how to develop a measure, a valid measure, an accurate measure of what the patient is experiencing. Now, you might say, well, why social scientists? The answer is that the social scientists have years of experience in measuring abstract concepts. Like, think about it, intelligence. It was the social scientists who said, well, we need to define intelligence, and then we need to think about how one would begin to measure it, and then we need to figure out how one would test the validity of our measurement tools. So they were way ahead of medical researchers in thinking about basic principles of measurement. And rheumatology, I should mention, was way ahead of dermatology in thinking about these issues. But it was this blending of two worlds, social science and medical science. I was in the right place at the right time and worked with social scientists at Case Western Reserve and developed a measure of the patient's experience of illness, which we call quality of life. It was able to test it and make sure that it measures what we want to measure, and it measures it accurately, and that it changes with time with the way it should. And that measure is called Skindex. And we then did the really fun part, which is that we could use that as a measure to compare different therapies for different diseases.
That's really fascinating. It's really interesting to try and come up with an objective measure of something that is really tied to the patient's subjective experience of a disease, so that you're able to determine what works and what doesn't. And it also got me thinking about when I was studying biomedical engineering, one of the key parts of creating an idea for a medical device is going back to the sociological anthropology, really, of patients' experiences with their healthcare. What is it that they need? What are their specific unmet needs? What goes into the Skindex tool? How is it used for different dermatologic diseases? And what are sort of the components that you're looking for when using it?
I'm interested that you're an engineer because I think I loved your story. You really, it's a fundamental step in being curious about any research idea, and people come to me with research ideas all the time, is asking the question, well, does this fill a gap? And you're
exactly.
saying the engineer is sort of an expert in filling gaps that people have in their lives. So it's a great story. And in fact, you've described the scientific process that somebody who's designing a quality of life measure would take, or that we took. So the first thing you say is, well, how do skin diseases affect people? And you find that out by asking people. And I'm not a qualitative researcher, but that's a branch of research called qualitative research. And we certainly did that for the development of the Skindex. So we talked to a wide swath of patients until what the social scientists call extinction, until they weren't bringing up any ways that their skin problems had affected them that we didn't already have in our coded notes. And so we were done. And then we reviewed all the notes that had been taken, the transcripts of all the interviews, and developed what's called a conceptual framework for the ways in which skin conditions affect people's lives. And that contained things that you might say were very predictable. Well, geez, it itches, it hurts. And some not so predictable. I'm sad because I feel dirty that I have a skin condition, or I feel like I gave it to myself, or I feel like my family gave it to me. So we basically cast the net broadly and had a very broad conceptual framework, a model, if you will, for the way skin conditions affect people. And then we composed with the social scientists items, which is the name for survey questions, that asked about each one of the ways that in the framework that skin conditions can affect people's lives. That left us with a very long, as you might imagine, ours was 72 items or something. And then we basically administered those to people. That's not the instrument. That's not the Skindex. That's sort of the prototype, right? And for some of those items, people said, I have no idea what this means. I don't know what it means. I don't understand it. And those items we got rid of. Not enough people responded. Not enough people understood what it was about. But at the end of the day, we were left with 30 items or so, 29 actually, that we could then test quantitatively to see if they appeared to be measuring the effect of skin disease on quality of life, if they were measuring it validly. So we made hypotheses and tested those hypotheses with a variety of multivariable analyses of data from having administered the items to patients. So the fundamental take-home message is you talk to patients first before you do the computer manipulation and the mathematical analyses that tests whether you're measuring what you want to measure, which is what validity is.
I think what's really striking is the fact that a lot of the psychological and psychosocial experiences of the patients, what those experiences are, really factor into what the Skindex has become as far as they feel sad, they feel dirty. I think that's one of the fascinating things about dermatology for me. It goes so much beyond what the physical appearance of something is, but at the heart of it is the patient's psychosocial experiences and the ramifications thereof. Especially if you're seeing patients that come from different cultural backgrounds, they all can have such very different psychosocial experiences with dermatological conditions. And I saw that the Skindex tool has been adapted for different countries, different languages, including Chinese and Turkish. I'm wondering what the process was like adapting it for these different languages and countries, and what were some of the challenges that came about in that process?
Yeah, you brought up a lot of interesting stuff, Grace. So you're quite right that different patients experience a given skin condition differently. And dermatologists instinctively understand this. So they know, anyone who's ever practiced dermatology knows that a skin rash that seems minimal in the office can greatly affect some patients, and a skin rash that seems extensive and alarming can not bother some other patients. So why should this be? And actually, that's not just a dermatologic phenomenon, but in just about every study of patients' experience of disease, angina, for example, heart disease, there is a correlation between how severe the angina is, how severe the skin disease is, and the way it affects the patient's quality of life. They are correlated statistically, but they're not redundant. And so that we found that in every study of quality of life that we've done in skin disease, that the correlations are, I don't know, 0.3 maybe. No, they're there, they're significant. So what's the take-home message? That an ideal approach to understanding how you've done, because you've taken care of the patient, is to have a measure of, is the rash better? Is the acne better? Is the psoriasis better? And that is done often with a physician judgment of how severe, just a simple 6-point scale. But then also asking the patient, and I see how your skin is. How are you doing? Let's have you just complete this instrument. And the Skindex isn't the only quality of life instrument. The most common one is a British instrument called the DLQI, the Dermatology Life Quality Index. It's used pretty commonly in clinical trials as well. But the important point is that the ideal approach to measurement would be to measure both the disease and how the patient's doing. I can't remember if I even got to your question.
It's okay. Yeah, but that is interesting. We'll get back to the question in a bit, but yeah, that's interesting how there's the DLQI. I've definitely heard of that and seen that reported in many a clinical trial. For our listeners, can you compare the DLQI with Skindex? What are the differences? What are the pros and cons of both?
Yeah, so the DLQI is 10 items. So it's the Skindex is a family of instruments. The two most common Skindexes are a 29-item more comprehensive tool and a 16-item shorter tool. And then there actually is a 3-item called the Skindex Mini now, which is specifically designed for use in large registries. You've asked a really good question. How do these two compare? And the answer is they compare really well. They basically highly correlate with each other. Most of the studies that have looked at this question highlight that the Skindex focuses and has more items related to the emotional effects of the skin condition. So the DLQI covers emotional effects in one item, which is sufficient for many clinical trials, but the Skindex fleshes that out a little more and asks about embarrassment, the many ways in which your emotions could be affected, worry, fear, anxiety, that kind of thing. Maybe it's that we were Americans and we were more into that, I don't know, than the British.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so, yeah, going back to my question from earlier about what was the process like for adapting Skindex to different countries and different languages? And what were the challenges that came about during that process?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And you're quite right. Different people from different cultures experience the items differently, right? And they also probably experience or undoubtedly experience the illness differently. So there's social scientists are rigorous, and there is a very choreographed set of steps that one should go through ideally to adapt an instrument made in the United States for other cultures. And by and large, we've followed that many times for the Skindex. And it consists of, first of all, identifying your collaborators, but a series of forward and back translations. And so let's just take Spanish for Mexican Americans. Remember, that could be different from Spanish for people from Puerto Rico or Spanish for people from Spain, for that matter. But let's just take Spanish for Mexican Americans. The instrument of Skindex would be translated by a dual speaker into Spanish and then translated back into English to see how similar the English back translation is to the original Skindex. And typically I get involved in that just because I'm very familiar with Skindex, and they send me the back translation and I sit at my computer and I have the back translation on one side and the original Skindex on the other side. And then I grade how closely these match. And often they're right on the money. They're the same, absolutely the same. But there are particular problematic items that in countless languages we found problems. Like the word embarrassed, frankly, which is in one of the Skindex versions, is often not understood or translated the same in different in other languages. Irritated. My skin is irritated is a real problem. Americans kind of know what that means. You know, like it just doesn't feel right. But I say it kind of disparagingly. Do they know what it means? We think they know what it means. No American has a problem with my skin's irritated. But that notion has been difficult to translate in other versions. I bring it up as a sort of just an example of some of the challenges. So then we tweak the items that weren't a perfect match. And then finally, we're left with a translated version that then gets tested in the population of interest and tested for validity and reliability and responsiveness.
That's really fascinating. And it made me think of a couple things. One is that there's a lot of languages in which there's multiple different words for just one singular English word. Like, for example, in English, it's only the word love. But if you take, say, like Chinese or Japanese, they have multiple different words that describe different types of love, but that English only has that one word and you have to use extra words to describe those singular words for that particular type of love. So I can see how that can really factor in as far as the culture's interpretation of irritation or discomfort or what have you. And then a more comedic sort of example of this as well is, I remember there is a YouTuber who's a musician. I think she does a series in which she takes popular Broadway songs, puts them through Google Translate, multiple different languages, all the way back to English, and she performs the Google Translate product that comes out at the very end. And you can see it's completely different from the original English. And so she's poking fun at how different it is.
That is a great, I'm definitely going to pull that up. I bet it's hilarious.
Yeah, I don't remember the name offhand. I'll have to look it up after this, but that is fascinating how that factored into the creation of Skindex for other languages as well. What do you think the future of Skindex is going to look like in the next 10 years or so? Is it going to be applied to additional dermatologic diseases or other languages, or are there other items that are yet to be added to the Skindex in the future?
So this is a far-reaching question. I spend most of my time running this department and was at a medical center-wide meeting yesterday. And the medical center, this large medical center, a lot like yours, like many of people who might listen to this, is trying to decide what sort of patient-reported outcomes measures, so what are called PROMs, should we be measuring on every patient? Do we even need to do this? What's the rationale for it? Vanderbilt's been measuring PROMs on every patient seen at Vanderbilt for probably 2 years. So there are millions of responses, which isn't necessarily a good thing because you got to think to yourself, gosh, what was the plan here? What was the rationale? Was this for research purposes? I'm stepping back. I'm going to say, what is the future of Skindex? What I think is really implicit in your question is, what is the future of patient reports in American medical care? I think it's going to be more and more and more important. So if you think about it, patient reports about their care, not about their disease, but about their care, are already extremely important in conventional measures of quality of care, like something called the Press-Ganey surveys. These are surveys, if you've ever been a patient, you've had to fill out about your experience getting medical care at this institution. And those are used to justify that the quality of care at that institution is okay. So already the system is set up to value patients' reports. What's harder is to incorporate into medical care without slowing it down a measure of the patient's experience of illness too. Because then if you think about the neat things you could do is plot, how was my patient doing? Let's just take the Skindex. 6 months ago, and then I started methotrexate, and then did that make them better? And you could see, and we have mock-ups of graphs that you could envision being in the medical record, in the electronic medical record, that told you in an instant, an era where you intervened with different drugs and how the patient was doing. So I think the future is very bright. We just have to make sure that we do nothing to slow down clinic or burden our clinicians even more than they already are with documentation. So, and where I'm going with this is that we need to have this happen sort of without the intervention of the doctor and measure the patient's experience electronically before he or she comes into the office.
That's the challenge, right? Making sure that the flow of your clinical practice isn't interrupted by this rather important aspect of medical care. And we see these graphs, especially as we mentioned earlier, the DLQI, we see these graphs for clinical trials. Why not for individual patients?
Great observation.
Going back to dermatology in general and your experience with going through the process of becoming a dermatologist, now that you are an attending, what would you say to your past self in medical school or internal medicine residency?
I think the importance of focusing on clinical mastery during a residency is discounted. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's hard to get into dermatology residency. So the most skilled applicants, or at least the very strategic applicants, often have a gauntlet that they walk through of certain number of papers and references and that sort of thing. And I think that what happens in residency is that, especially those doing fellowships, but even those heading for practice, often focus on getting to the finish line and forgetting that the mastery of clinical dermatology is an investment in your future, no matter what you do. Even if you are a researcher, having mastered clinical dermatology is always something that during your day in clinic will just give you joy because you have mastered it. Yeah, I wish I'd told myself or that someone had impressed upon me that every day in which you get better and better and better is really, really worth it. I was lucky to be in a place that placed a great value on that, but I worry that sometimes that people are just trying to get through to the end. And so I think we need to hold clinical mastery up as the goal for a residency.
Absolutely. The journey is always going to be the reward.
Yeah. Well, this is a reward that pays even after the journey's over.
That's true.
and just a joyous life, professional life.
Absolutely. One of the biggest pieces of advice I got even before starting medical school was to enjoy every little moment along the way. I've heard it being put that way. And then an alternative way is whatever stage of the medical training process that you're in, always think to yourself, say, for example, I'm in medical school right now. This is going to be the best 4 years of my life. And then say I go into residency. This is also going to be the best 4 years of my life. So just really making the most of whatever stage that you're in, because who knows, whatever you learn in medical school, you might not get to learn again. Whatever you learn in residency, you might not necessarily get to see again, but you're prepared on the rare occasion that does come in the door.
Absolutely. Well said. And there's great joy in that mastery.
Absolutely. What would you say is your favorite dermatologic condition to treat?
So I have two. One is going to be a surprise. It's very tremendously rewarding to take care of patients whose itching is relieved. The most common example probably is people who have atopic dermatitis. Their quality of life is greatly affected by this itching. They can't sleep. It affects every aspect of their functioning. And then when they're properly treated, their lives are turned around. And I also have an affection for treating patients who have, I delusions of parasitosis, which is a monosymptomatic delusion in which, for reasons we don't understand, the patient is convinced that that he or she is infested. Usually these patients are often see several dermatologists and have a million tests and a million biopsies, none of which is revealing. And if one can establish a therapeutic relationship with this patient, something along the lines of, this is really bothersome to you. We understand that it is. We don't understand how this happens, honestly, but we see other patients who have this as well. Many of them do better when we co-manage with someone from mental health. And we are not going to abandon you with this, but we're going to work together with our mental health colleagues and making a difficult encounter sound easy. But the way that the proper treatment with an antipsychotic medicine can turn life around for these patients is pretty dramatic.
Absolutely. It's just a matter of getting to that part.
Right. Exactly right.
Yeah. And about itching as well, I actually, on one of my dermatology rotations during our didactic sessions, there was, I think it was a third year dermatology resident from another program that came to visit and give a lecture, because before she considered dermatology, she was considering neurology. And then she found out that she was really interested in the neurologic pathways that contribute to the sensation of pruritus. The first part of her presentation was about the basic science behind the neurological pathways that lead to pruritus. And that in itself was so fascinating. And then she went on to talk about technological advancements that are currently being developed to address different aspects of pruritus. One thing that stood out to me was, it's almost like a heat map, but for pruritus, where they're looking at, I clearly remember it was an animation of, it was an infant. As the infant was sleeping, this device was detecting how much and how often the baby was scratching different parts of the body, and those would light up as red. As someone who studied biomedical engineering, of course, that stuck with me. And I thought, this is going to be huge when it's more fully developed in the future. Bottom line is, there's a lot of fascinating things regarding pruritus. And
no kidding.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. And a great place for an engineer to think about new ways to help.
Absolutely. That's one of my many goals. And then my final question for you is, what additional final advice do you have for any medical students that might be listening and considering applying to dermatology, or any non-dermatology related life advice you might have?
Oh my goodness. Well, I don't know that I would feel, you probably get a lot of non-dermatology advice for students that are interested in dermatology. It goes without saying that you got to spend some time with a dermatologist. It's not everyone's cup of tea. You know, for example, it's 99% ambulatory care. We do have a very busy, all of academic medical centers have busy inpatient consult services, but by and large, a dermatologist is in clinic, and that isn't everyone's cup of tea. So make sure that you've decided that that's what you like. And then I would say, in the application process and in the interview process, I would urge everybody to talk about making choices that will lead you to be the best doctor at the end of the day. So what kind of internship are you going to do? That's a common interview question. I want to choose an internship that it's the best one I can get into, because I'll never have that experience again. And I want to be the best doctor I can be. That's very compelling to an interview committee, because they like to think that they're good doctors and they're in an academic center. And so they like to think that that's what you value too. And then the last point that I'll end with is just that also gives you an end plate to swim toward in the swimming of life. That end plate is, I'm going to be the best doctor I can be.
That also reminded me of something that I thought of earlier, as far as embracing the opportunity to learn various things at the stage that you're currently in while you can. When I was studying biomedical engineering, I made sure to take all of my electives were specifically within biomedical engineering. So, for example, tissue engineering, just learning about engineering advancements for skin grafts. you know, I wasn't going to learn that again. And so that was because there was the option to take an immunology elective. I knew I did that in medical school. So I wanted to take that opportunity and fill it with knowledge about skin graft engineering, you know, things like that. And so definitely one major take-home point I think a lot of medical students should really keep in mind as they go through what seems to be a really long part of the medical training process, but well worth it for sure.
And goes fast.
it gets faster with each progressing year.
Absolutely.
Dr. Kren, thank you so much again for being on the DIGA podcast.
It was my pleasure and great meeting you, Grace.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the DIGA podcast. We hope you enjoyed. Please send us any questions or comments to derminterestpod@gmail.com.
This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.